Please, and Mr. Stallard.
Morning once again, how are you? May it please the court, this case...
Excuse me, would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, please, 3 minutes.
I'm sorry, very good. And let me ask you, let's just go to the heart of the matter right off the bat. Is this case controlled by Burke?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Okay, then why do we not have the issue of harmless error?
Because unlike in Burke, I don't believe that the evidence was as uncontradicted as it was in Burke. Burke was a case of a person driving an habitual offender, and in that one I don't think it was contested whether he was a habitual offender, whether he had been declared habitual offender, whether he knew he had been declared habitual offender, or even that he was driving. For all intents and purposes, that seemed to be, I guess in the defense lingo, a slow guilty plea where the client was putting on the best that he could, hoping that through some miracle that he might be successful in the course of the trial. This case is not like that, however. At every turn in the case, it was contested whether Mr. Rogers had thrown anything out of the car. It was contested whether even, in fact, a firearm was thrown out of the car, because as the officer clearly stated, what he'd seen was an oblong object flutter out in an arc fashion out the passenger window of the car. He was not even the one that had gone back to the bush area and discovered a firearm in the area. It was another officer, in fact, it was Officer Samuel, who was the officer in my previous case as well, that was there with his canine that discovered it. So the question is whether the Commonwealth was able to connect points A to point C, and in this case, where we're submitting that they cannot, then it is not as clear a case as the Commonwealth would assert, and we submit that it would not be harmless error. And I would submit to the court that what we've got here, I think in the language of the Supreme Court case, forgive me if I mangle this, Kotikas versus the United States at 328 U.S. 750, the issue is whether, when all is said and done, the conviction is sure that the error did not influence the jury or had but slight effect, the verdict and the judgment should stand. But if one cannot say with fair assurance, after pondering all that happened without stripping the erroneous action from the whole, that the judgment was not substantially swayed by the error, it's impossible to conclude that substantial rights were not affected, or if one is left in grave doubt, then the conviction cannot stand. Although the evidence may have raised a suspicion of Mr. Rogers' involvement in this, that is purely an issue for the jury to decide. And when they've been influenced, as they obviously were, by the fact that these prior conviction orders with the sentencing information had been presented to them, and they obviously had considered that in their deliberations of guilt when they asked the question whether or when he had been released from probation and prison, it's clear that the jury had that on their mind at the time they're delivering the facts of the case that led to the ultimate conclusion of the conviction. It's you know, for us to be mind readers and say that with this the jury would have done this, without this the jury would have done this, it's impossible to say. But our position is that where the evidence was not as clear cut as the Commonwealth would have us believe, where there was no DNA, no fingerprints on the firearm, the officer couldn't even say that it was Mr. Rogers himself, his arm coming out of the car, throwing the object that was somehow later connected to be a firearm. There are just too many holes in the progression of the case to be able to say that it is clear cut as the Burke evidence was, and thus we would submit that it is not harmless error.
Ms. Ortiz, tell me if I'm saying anything that's incorrect. Officers saw a dark colored object, dark oblong object. Come from the passenger side where the defendant was, landed in the bushes. There was residue found on the defendant's on both hands. The only two people in the vehicle were defendant and battle. Why isn't that fairly strong evidence that he possessed the gun?
I think the distinction.
He'd have been convicted all day long.
I'm sorry, sir?
He'd have been convicted all day long on that testimony, wouldn't he?
I don't know that he would have, Your Honor, and we're not conceding that he would. Because what the forensics expert testified to is that it was a residue indicative of primer, not that it was actually primer residue. And he also stated that it could be deposited there by handling a firearm, by firing a firearm, or coming into contact with something or somebody who had handled a firearm. And I think that raises the question, when you've got the other passenger or the driver of the car who actually was found to have actual primer residue particle on her hands, but Mr. Rogers only has something that is indicative of, but not actually is, primer residue. I think it's a distinction that is important in this case, because we don't know how that could have been deposited.
Let's forget about the residue. The gun came out of the car where on the defendant's side of the car. The object came out of the car from the passing the defendant's side of the car, and they found the gun exactly where that object landed.
Well, yeah, I think that might be, with all respect, a mischaracterization of the evidence.
Okay.
Because the officer said that it was in the general area. He did not actually put eyes on the site where the object had landed, because he was concentrating on the car as he was following it.
Okay.
It just went to a general area. And then when they did, in fact, find the weapon, they indicated it had been raining that day, that the weapon was wet, and it was actually covered by some wet leaves. So the question remains, if this is an object that has just been thrown out of the interior of a car, which there was no evidence that there was wet inside of the car, how then is the gun found in a condition where it's wet and covered with wet leaves? I think that leads to a more reasonable conclusion that the gun had been there for some time, not that it had just been thrown out of the thrown
Counsel,
out of the
wasn't
vehicle.
There, I'm sure your memory's better than mine, but wasn't there a cartridge or bullets found in the car that were consistent with the caliber gun that was found?
Actually, I think the information was that it was not consistent.
Was not? Okay, very good.
And that, I think, is important as well, because if, in fact, it had been the same caliber as the weapon that had been thrown out of, or presumably thrown out of, I'm not conceding that, as the weapon that they found in the bushes, I think that would be a stronger connection for the Commonwealth. But, in fact, they weren't. And I think that is another area that leaves some question, some doubt. And when we don't know precisely what the jury was considering or how they considered that sentencing information in their conclusions, I think as stated in the brief, you know, we do have to speculate a certain amount. Did they take that into consideration in deciding that they didn't believe Ms. Battle when she testified that Mr. Rogers didn't throw
the gun? Was there any other object other than the gun found in that same area where that object was thrown?
Not that was testified to, Your Honor. I don't think there was any evidence that the officers found anything else of consequence, but I don't know that that necessarily means that there weren't any other objects. It's just that that's the one that they concentrated on, because obviously, it presumably, would be the contraband item they would suspect in this kind of case.
Ms. Ortiz, what about back at the apartment building where the alleged shooting occurred? Were there any bullets or cartridges that were consistent with the gun that was found there?
Well, it was the same caliber, but there was no match. I don't know if they actually submitted it for comparison, but my understanding is that whatever firearm had been discharged at the apartments, it was the same caliber, but there was no evidence before the court to show that bullets from that weapon matched the bullets from the gun that was found in the bushes.
Didn't the same type of vehicle that was seen leaving the area when the shooting occurred match the description of the vehicle that the appellant was in?
I don't recall, Your Honor. But, Your Honor, I would also submit that when the officer, in fact, turned on his lights and siren, the vehicle did not act in an invasive manner, such as you would expect from somebody either that had been involved in a recent discharge of a firearm or a vehicle that had passengers in it that were trying to dispose of contraband. Instead, as Ms. Battle had stated, she continued to drive, didn't speed up, didn't try and evade the officer. I don't think there's any evidence from the officer that she attempted to do so, but instead pulled into a well-lit area, bypassing another parking lot, because as she testified, the JB's Gallery of Girls was known to be a high crime area. Now, that raises one other question. I don't think it's clear from the record where this bush area was in relation to where JB's Gallery of Girls was. But if, in fact, that is a high-crime area, then it does raise another possible alternative, that, in fact, is as a result of the high crime in that area that the gun had been deposited, not that this was the object that had been thrown from the vehicle.
Counsel, after the jury retired and the foreman submitted a question, when was the defendant released from prison still on probation? With the agreement of both parties, the circuit court responded, you're not to be concerned with any matters touching on any possible previous incarceration or possible previous probation. That's simply not an issue.
We are, if the court is saying, was that an appropriate cautionary instruction, our position would be that it was not, because it was not made to the jury at the time the evidence was introduced before, over counsel's objection.
But counsel agreed to that cautionary instruction.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, she'd be in a difficult position if she said, no, Your Honor, I'm not going to agree to a cautionary instruction, and then later be called on the carpet for it in front of the Court of Appeals saying, well, you didn't ask for a cautionary instruction. It's sort of a, forgive the language, but damned if you do and damned if you don't. At that point, the damage has already been done. And what was interesting in the progression of the case is that initially when counsel objected to the order being admitted, the court indicated that he was inclined to agree. The Commonwealth was getting ready to redact the very information that was the subject of the objection. It was only after the judge came back from recess that I don't agree with that. I'm going to allow the order in that it proceeded at that point. I think to a certain extent, I think the defense was sort of caught off guard because prior to the recess, the attorney for the Commonwealth had even agreed that that was the state of the law at the time. In the end, Your Honors, I don't think we can say with any clarity that the jury was not influenced by the admission of that by the sentencing order. And where it's unclear, where the evidence is contested, where it's not, a slam dunk for the Commonwealth, where there are sufficient other issues raised during the course of the trial regarding the defendant's possession of the firearm, we submit that it did not constitute harmless error, and we would ask the court to reverse and remand.
Thank you, Ms. Ortiz. Mr. Stallard.
May it please the court. Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor, I would suggest to the court that this is more than ample evidence to sustain a conviction regardless of the evidence that was improperly admitted. Here we have a police officer who's on the lookout for a vehicle matching the description of one that was seen at a shooting. This vehicle matches that description. It's a dark-colored SUV. He falls in behind that vehicle. He testifies that his lights, the spotlight, and the traffic lights are all on the vehicle. He's paying close attention to it because it potentially was involved in a shooting. The car slows down. It does pass several well-lit areas before eventually stopping. During this time, the officer also observes a dark oblong object coming out of the passenger vehicle. And I think importantly, the arc of this object goes above the roof line before landing on the side of the road. Such an angle would be difficult, if not impossible, for someone in the driver's position to lean over to throw something out of the vehicle at such an angle that it would leave and go on an arc above the roof line. It would be much more simple for someone sitting in the passenger seat to take an object and throw it out so that it would go above the roof line before landing. So I think that's an important factor as well. The car does eventually stop. The police goes back. Another officer goes back to the scene where the object was seen coming out of the vehicle. And in that area, they do, in fact, recover a firearm. And in addition to recovering a firearm where it was seen, an object was seen coming out of the vehicle, the passenger and the driver both tested for primer residue. They both test positive for it. The driver's side is only possible residue. It's the defendant who is a passenger is highly indicative of primer residue. So he had more particles on his hand that were more indicative of primer residue than the driver did. And again, it's not required for the driver, the passenger, to actually be in physical possession of the gun. If it's in the car, he's aware of its nature and character and can exercise dominion and control, that's possession. I think the Commonwealth established that he did, in fact, have actual physical possession of the firearm beyond a reasonable doubt, but they weren't required to prove that. They just required to prove aware of the nature and character, because there was also a clip in the car found loaded for a different type of gun that was also in the vehicle, which also would be illegal for a felon to possess as well. But in addition, the only question the jury asked was, when did he get off probation, when did he get out of jail? There's no indication that's a factor they considered after being instructed, like, you don't concern yourself with this, you don't do that. Juries are presumed to follow the instructions. There's no indication that they did consider this. Because the evidence was ample and sufficient and credible to find the defendant guilty, there's no evidence the jury, in fact, ever considered this improperly admitted evidence. The court, I would ask this court to affirm. I'd be happy to address any questions the court may have.
Thank you, Mr. Sallon.
I need to sign this. I'll do that after you.
I'll just end with this. It sort of begs the question. If the jury didn't consider it in their deliberations, why did they ask the question? And I think that in itself indicates that that was weighing heavily on their mind at the time that they're making the very important and life-changing deliberations as to whether Mr. Rogers was guilty or not of these offenses. The Commonwealth also suggests that all they would have had to prove was that Mr. Rogers was aware of the nature and character of the gun, etc. But that's not what the theory of the case was that was presented to the jury. They're actually proceeding on the theory that Mr. Rogers actually had physical possession of it. It was him that threw this object out of the window. The jury wasn't given this alternative theory on which to rely. And if that had been the case, we'd still be left in the position of what effect did the sentencing order have on their deliberations. And I'll just circle back to the if the gun had been used in the shooting. Let's say that it had. Wouldn't it be logical to conclude then you'd expect to find more than a single particle of primer residue on Ms. Battle's hands and just a few particles highly indicative of primer residue on Mr. Rogers' hands? I think that undermines the Commonwealth's very own case there, that based on the recency of what had occurred, you would have expected to find something much more substantial than what was actually found.
Thank you, Ms. Ortiz. We will come down and greet counsel.